From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. It's Labor Day weekend. With this holiday traditionally marks the end of the summer vacation season with one more chance at relaxation and refreshment, this year many of us are focused on widespread death and devastation all around us in the wake of massive storms. Our thoughts are with those who have lost so much in recent days. Here on State of Belief, we take this hour to revisit some of our favorite conversations from past shows.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and looming theocracy. The Supreme Court of the United States deferred to the supremacy of the political religious right this week, ruling that odious new restrictions on reproductive rights in Texas, along with noxious vigilante campaigns to spy on and report on neighbors by neighbors in the service of religion-scented control of women's bodies, were perfectly constitutional. It's going to take writers with nerves of steel to apply this new standard to most of the other freedoms previously identified by SCOTUS as of yore and figure out what restrictions are likely to be coming next. But for all those progressives who've been mouthing for years, sure, they're conservatives, they're religious ideologues, but they can't touch Roe. You can't say we didn't warn you, but you probably will anyway. I could move on to another headline, but let's just remember how shamelessly Mitch McConnell and co. blocked any consideration of now Attorney General Merrick Garland for a seat on the court, how they managed to re-enable the confirmation process for Neil Gorsuch, how they conveyed Brett Kavanaugh and his baggage through to the dismay of almost the entire legal profession in this country, and the breathtaking hypocrisy of Amy Coney Barrett, express confirmed to the acclamation of those who have long ago revealed that their loyalty is not to our democracy, but to their own hold on power. The denial and rationalizations on the political left in this country enabled this slippery slope, and that's who's going to continue to be most impacted for decades to come. That's all I've got time for, sorry. Happy Labor Day. This year, that also means if you get pregnant, you're more likely than ever to have no choice but eventually be in labor.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please know how grateful we are for that. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Reverend James Forbes, welcome to State of Belief.
And I'm happy to be with you, Welton.
A lot of people ask me a lot of the time, and I bet they ask you too, what is progressive Protestantism, or what is progressive religion?
Well, I would go to the Bible first, which is not always the way you would answer that question. But there is in it this expression from Jesus. Jesus tells his disciples when he's getting ready to leave them, "I have many things to say to you. However, I cannot say it now. But the Spirit of truth will lead you into all truth." That is my jumping off point for understanding progressive Protestantism and also progressive Christianity and progressive religion. It is based on the affirmation of certain basic principles that have come with the tradition. But it understands that tradition is an evolving dynamic, and therefore people must be open to new data, new insights, as they seek to live out their existence. Science gives us new information, psychology, history, even biology. As these social sciences give new insight, and even literature, new insights, a progressive learns to incorporate new insights into their understanding, and they want to, shall I say, progress in the development of tradition so that there is relevance to the contemporary age. A progressive always is heard to say, go forth, don't stand still, embrace the future with confidence that the Lord who gave you a mind expects you to use that as well as you use your heart in devotion to God.
Jim, you know and I know that you cause some trouble for some people because you break stereotypes. I mean, here you are beginning to talk about progressive religion, and you talk about the Holy Spirit, and then in the very first of your book, you jump into a chapter on sexuality. Now, that keeps people off balance.
Well, I'll tell you what. If they're dealing with sexuality, they are likely from time to time to be off balance. Sexuality is such a powerful gift from God. It is so powerful that it can sometimes even serve as a surrogate God. People can build their lives around it, and their values become subservient to its demand. My thinking is that any religion that cannot help us to know how to steer our way between the high standards to which we are called and the relentless energy, impulse, and intrigue of sexuality, if it can't help us to get through the Scylla and Charybdis of that kind of force, then it's lacking in what's necessary, because that's only one of the major problems.
Jim, this subject has been a part of your pilgrimage. You talk about it in the book as a subject on which your views have changed, particularly about homosexuality and equality for LGBT people. Will you talk briefly about your evolution here?
I grew up in the Black Pentecostal Church in the Bible Belt, and in that context, preachers often would rail against people because they had a different sexual orientation. If you, in my childhood church, if you were even thought to be gay or lesbian, then you would expect that sermons were going to be preached about you and you were going to be preached into hell. I grew up in that and therefore had this really great fear about homosexuality, and anybody that I thought was that way, I would want to shun them because, I mean, those people are clearly going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, something about that felt in contrast to the spirit of acceptance and the spirit of love that I thought I heard them preaching about Jesus. So for me, I started to ask, okay, so these are the rules and regulations, but what about the spirit of Christ? As I moved in my educational development, I came to understand you're going to have to make a decision. First, you got to figure out what kind of God are we serving. Is this God who's very punitive, or is this God very accepting? Is this God the God who simply wants me to make everybody else the extension of my image, or does that God have space for folks that are different from me? As I developed, I came to believe first about God, that God loves us, that God made us all, and clearly that God understands us. And I even came to believe that maybe God made some folks different from me so as to help me begin to understand that I am not the paragon of virtue such that everything should be modeled on me. If I can only love, appreciate, and affirm folks like me, the King James Version would say, what thank have you? So I started to say, my God is much more likely to draw a circle to include than to exclude. And then science helped me out a lot when it made it very clear that, yes, the issue of choice may be at points a part of what determines our sexuality, but fundamentally, our sexuality is a part of our genetic inheritance. That is, that which gives us delight, that which is a positive fantasy for us, that which gives us our attraction, is not just a matter of folks saying, maybe I'll be gay, maybe I'll be straight. That there is much more of a deposit in our genes of the kinds of persons we would be in regards to the approach we would take to our sexual expression. That made me say that just like nobody can tell me to stop being black so I can be more righteous in their eyes, nor can I tell somebody to stop being gay so that they can be more conveniently configured as I would wish them to be configured in my straight way. I think I'm a better Christian for having the capacity to let God love gay people as much as I'm happy that God loves me.
My guest today is Reverend James Forbes. We're talking about his new book, Whose Gospel? Concise Guide to Progressive Protestantism. Jim, thanks for staying with us.
Pleasure.
I want to acknowledge your chapter on race and racial equality. In that narrative, you share a personal story about the first time that you were able to eat at a lunch counter in the South. What happened that day?
That day, January 11th, 1961, was the day that I decided to go down and for the first time eat at the Woolworth lunch counter. Before that, we would get our food from a window because black people and white people were not supposed to sit down together in places of public accommodation. But my brother, who was the president of Shaw University, had led a march and protest, and the Woolworth counter was open to black people. I went down to buy myself, in the old Southern way, a hot dog with mustard, relish, and ketchup, and a big orange. When I sat down at that counter, there was a white woman to my right. She had her food there, but immediately as I sat down, she got up and ran out of the store. I was so disturbed until I really don't know even now whether I even ever ordered my meal. So I went home, and my mother always told us, when something happens to you, don't let it get the best of you. Find a creative way to express it. So I did. I wrote this poem. Why did she move when I sat down? Surely she could not tell so soon that my Saturday bath had worn away, or that savage passion had pushed me for a rape. Perhaps it was the cash she carried in her purse. She could not risk a theft so early in the month, and who knows that on tomorrow 'twould fall her lot to drink her coffee from a cup my darkened hands had clutched. So horrible was that moment, I too should have run away, for prejudice has the odor of a dying beast, whether racist or rapist. Both fall in the savage class, and the greatest theft of all is to rob one's right to be. Now, this is what I wrote, but the real issue, the real beauty of the story, it seems to me, is that 30 years later, when I was the pastor at the Riverside Church, one of my white parishioners came to me and said, you know, I wanted to see you because I was working through some of my papers, and I ran across this letter that you wrote me back in 1961, and in it there was this poem. Question: why would I send that poem to a white woman? Answer: she was working at the United Church, had programs for black youth, and had convinced all of us that she really loved us, that she really cared for us, that it mattered to her what hurt us, and also she was invested in making sure that we would be first-class citizens just like anybody else. The fact that there were two women in that town, Raleigh, North Carolina, one who, at my presence, ran away, the other giving of her energy to help me affirm my existence as a child of God, that helped me to overcome the tendency to be racialistic in my thinking. You can't put all white people in one basket. You can't put all black people in one basket. It has kept me open to say, in each race, black or white or Latino or Asian or whatever, look at the person, because it is possible that there are always people in these groups that will that will in some way defy the stereotypes we may have developed about them.
Jim, I think that it's a long way chronologically from where you were that day at the lunch counter to where you are today. My own assumption is, however, in the geography of the soul, it's a pretty short distance between where you were that day and why you're doing some of what you're doing today. I have in mind specifically your organization, the Healing of the Nations Foundation, where you are interested, compelled, committed to work at healing, healing the divisions of our country, healing the divisions of our world. I guess the basic question that I know many people will ask about that is that realistic? What gives you hope that such a foundation can find any success?
Well, the first response is that I have learned through the Bible that God is so invested in our healing that in Ezekiel, there's a reference to a tree that brings forth fruit, but that the leaves were for medicine. God wanted us to be have access to what would heal us so that the leaves of the tree would have medicinal properties. I got this revelation that when it talks about leaves, the Bible is really referring to people. There is, therefore, in every human being an immune system, which is a God-given capacity to help heal yourself. So let me tell you, healing is happening all the time. But there's another interesting thing, that whatever God gives us for ourselves, God also gives us something to share with others. So not only is it true that I have the capacity to heal myself, I and you and everybody else, we all have the capacity to heal others. I do not necessarily mean medically, though that's included too. Body, mind, spirit, emotions, your vocations, your relationships, your community, and even the environment. In one or the other of these ways, everybody is capable of healing somebody. So I'm thinking that when times get rough, like in Haiti, there is a residual compassion in people. It tends normally only to be activated in times of crisis or great catastrophe. My work would be to help people before the tsunami hits or before the hurricane or before the earthquake. What about beginning to practice healing? Each of us as a leaf should be conscientious about our own health and invest in the health of others. Let's make sure that each of us will heal as many as we can. And guess what? That could be $1 trillion off the budget. Because when we start giving attention to preventive health care and to encourage others to be conscientious about their health, maybe we would discover hidden resources for a more just, a more peaceful, and a more healthy world.
Jim, you point out in the book that you never really wanted to be a minister. In fact, quite the opposite. You specifically did not want to be a minister. But I'm going to tell you, if that attitude had stayed, if that decision hadn't changed, there would be a lot of disappointed people if you'd done something else, and there'd be a lot of us and our world deprived of something that has touched us that feels good and instructive and inspirational and like a blessing.
Oh, thank you, Walter. A man needs a good friend like you.
We're just getting started with this Labor Day edition of the Best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. There's more coming right up. In her book, The Great Emergence, religious historian Phyllis Tickle observes that every 500 years or so, the Christian faith holds what she dubs a rummage sale. a way for the church to reevaluate itself, keep what it needs to keep, shed what it doesn't. In her timeline, Tickle points to the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire around 500, the Great Schism around 1000, and then in 1500, the Great Reformation, that pivotal moment that began when Martin Luther questioned the nature of his religion and how it was practiced. And now, here we are, 5 centuries after Luther and his 95 Theses, and Christianity is undoubtedly in a time of flux. Some would even say crisis. We've witnessed splits in the Episcopal and Lutheran churches over the question of homosexuality, and denominations across the board are struggling with any number of issues and reporting record losses in membership. So, is it time for another rummage sale? Or, as my next guest puts it, is it time for the 96th thesis? Brian McLaren is an author, a speaker, a pastor. His numerous books include A New Kind of Christian and Everything Must Change. Now he's back with another one. The latest is called A New Kind of Christianity, 10 Questions That Are Transforming the Faith. Brian McLaren, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's great to be back at State of Belief, and thanks for that good introduction.
Your book begins with a realization that you shared with others in different Christian communities. You say you all agreed that something isn't working in the way we're doing Christianity anymore. What brought you to that conclusion?
Well, I suppose a number of things. The strongest would be my own experience as a pastor. When I would sit across the table with someone, across the desk from someone who had begun visiting my church, and they would begin asking me their questions, and I would think about the kind of answers that I had been taught or had been given myself when I asked questions, I just realized something wasn't matching up, you know. I didn't have good answers to a lot of the good questions that were being raised.
Well, I want to get into the details of some of the 10 questions that you pose in the book, but first, I have to point out that we're talking about very large questions here, questions about the nature of God, the message of the gospel, and it makes me think that you're saying that Christians basically need to go back to the drawing board and ask, what do we believe? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think it is a fair assessment. I mean, on the one hand, I'm not recommending that we hop, skip, and jump over 2,000 years of church history and just ignore all of that and go back to the Bible and now we'll get it all right and fix it all up. I don't want to leave anything behind. I want to learn from all of our history. But I do think we've got a number of reasons these days to say, well, let's go back and try to get a fresh vision of what Jesus really was about. And let's look back at our history and see not only the great heroes and the great breakthroughs and the great resources that have come from our faith, but let's also be honest about some of those more painful things, some of the moral failures of our history, and let's try to learn from those mistakes as well.
Well, you begin with the narrative of the Bible itself. Many Christians and probably non-Christians believe the Bible to begin with what we call the fall, when Adam and Eve ate the fruit in the Garden of Eden. Some people say it was an apple. The human race then is condemned to a life of suffering because of that original sin, which in some way influences people even today. Those who repent end up in heaven. Those who aren't, quote, saved end up in hell. But I don't think that's the narrative as you see it, is it?
Well, that's the narrative I was taught. But what I've been doing, you know, it's funny when you're a pastor and you preach every Sunday and sometimes many times a week, you actually spend a lot of time in the Bible. And what I began to feel was that when I would read a story, like the story of Adam and Eve in the garden and eating of the fruit, there were two layers of activity going on. One was what's there in the text, and then the other is all of the interpretations that I was that I inherited and I was taught that I would bring to the text. And one of the things I think all of us who are serious students of the Bible want to do is we want to realize that our interpretation isn't exactly the same thing as the text, and that there might be other ways to read the text.
I really like the analogy that you use in the book. You say the Bible is not a constitution, it's more like a library.
Well, that's really one of the seminal ideas that I hope will be helpful from the book. A lot of us have been taught to read the Bible as if it were a constitution, and it's not surprising we would do that. We live in constitutional democracies, and constitutions are very sacred to us in the political realm, and so we would. It's no surprise we pay the Bible a compliment by treating it as if it were a constitution. The problem is, when the Bible was written, there was no such thing as a constitution. Mm. And so to put the Bible in that category is a category mistake. And what I found to be a much more respectful way of understanding the Bible is to let the Bible be what it is, a collection of documents written by something like 40 people over a couple thousand, from many centuries to two millennia, depending on the scholarship you follow. But so in that way, it ends up being a library. And for us as Christians, we believe it's a unique library. In fact, we use the highest language we can use to describe it. We believe it's an inspired library. But the purpose of a library is different from the purpose of a constitution. And one simple way to say it is a constitution tries to remove all debate and to just present one clear interpretation, and even trying to do that, of course, constitutional lawyers have a lot of arguments. Yeah. But a library tries to preserve key arguments. It tries to preserve different voices in the conversation that goes on in a culture. Mm-hmm. And when we allow the Bible to be read that way, suddenly it becomes, to me, a lot more dramatic, and I think we feel we're being more fair to the Bible itself.
My guest is Brian McLaren. We're talking about his new book, A New Kind of Christianity. You say that Jesus has been the victim of identity theft. I want to find out what that means, because those who see Jesus as the ultimate warrior type, you mentioned those, but then there are also these people who hold the viewpoint that Jesus was one who preached to the poor and advocated social justice. What is his identity?
Well, you know, there's another one of those arguments that have been going on for centuries. And
you've got two minutes to answer it.
To totally solve it for the rest of history. Well, maybe I could say this. What I'm recommending we do is focus on the portraits of Jesus that were given in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And if we focus on those portraits of Jesus and let those predominate, I think that will resolve an awful lot of our problem. One of the main complications in getting a picture of Jesus is that people take one chapter from the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, and they use that chapter. I think they misinterpret that chapter. But they use it to overturn the whole portrait of Jesus that we get in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That Jesus is a man of peace and nonviolence and reconciliation, and this portrait that I think they misinterpret from the book of Revelation is a guy with a sword in his hand and just another religious warrior. Mm. There would be one example of how it really is a life and death matter, mm-hmm. how we interpret and understand the Bible, and especially our understanding of Jesus.
As you very well know, I live in Washington, D.C., as well as in Monroe, Louisiana, where the church is. But in Washington, I talk to a lot of people who at least give the impression that there has been some great revival of religion on Capitol Hill. Speeches are filled with religious imagery and even quoting verses of scripture and hymns. That was in my mind as I read some of what you were writing about reclaiming Christianity and the way it has dealt with issues. And it occurred to me, Brian, that in some ways, the politicians have tried to steal issues that were moral long before they were political. And you're saying that, which I think you're saying, that what you've described really had not so much to do with politics at all. Am I reading that right?
Well, if I understand you right, I think that what this book, New Kind of Christianity, does, among other things, is suggest that just because you quote the Bible, that doesn't guarantee that you're on the side of right.
Uh-huh.
The Bible can be quoted and used for people who are motivated more by the love of power than they are by the power of love, if I could say it that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the great struggles in our political realm is to not be seduced just because people, claim they quote the Bible and use religious language. We have to be careful because clever politicians can easily use the Bible and religious language to get votes to agendas that really are not in sync with a mature and healthy understanding of Jesus and his gospel. And when we look back in history, we can just see this. We've all heard of the book Uncle Tom's Cabin, a powerful novel by Harriet Beecher Stowe, a committed Christian who was writing against slavery. What we don't know is that there were a lot of other novels. One of them was called Nellie Norton, and it was a novel using the Bible to defend slavery. So this is a time for us to try to be a little more clever and savvy and not get sucked into to being misled in a lot of these highly charged political debates.
Ryan, I want to return to an image that I referred to in the introduction, the image put forth by Phyllis Tickle, that of a rummage sale. What are we selling? What do we keep?
Yeah. Well, one of the really central issues in my mind is this. Is the gospel of Jesus primarily a message about the protection of an elite few and special privileges for an elite few, leaving all the rest into condemnation? Or is the gospel of Jesus Christ about God's love for all the world, all creation, beginning with the least and the last, beginning with the poor and the oppressed? Is the gospel primarily a message of evacuation, how some of us can get out of here, get to heaven, and leave the whole mess behind? Or is the gospel a message of incarnation and penetration, about God coming into this world and bringing grace and hope and healing into this world with all of its trouble? What I hope we'll see happen in the years ahead is that we'll put the old furniture out on the sidewalk,
mm-hmm.
and say, that's up for sale. We really want to try to get a purer and deeper and more healthy and Christ-like understanding of what it means to be Christian.
Brian, on State of Belief, our listeners are comprised probably at least 50% by people who have been hurt by religion, who have turned away from religion, or who have no relationship with institutional religion. Some are agnostics by profession. Some are atheists by profession. Now, they're sitting here listening to two Christian pastors talk about their tradition, their theology. What do you hope that someone who's not a part of our tradition, someone who may have a very negative attitude toward religion, what do you hope that person takes away from what we've been discussing?
Yeah. Well, one of our great problems is that if you notice how much bad religion there is out there, you can sometimes just hope that the whole thing would go away. But I think history tells us that the best alternative to bad religion is not no religion, it's better religion, if I can put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
We might say something similar with families. We've all been part of or know dysfunctional families where horrible, horrible abuse and pain and suffering takes place. And so we might say, let's get rid of families and just try to factory produce people or something, you know. Mm. But in the long run, the best alternative to bad families is healthy and loving families. And this, to me, is our great challenge. How can we create an approach to faith and spirituality, to our place in the world, our relationship to all the mysteries and meaning of life that can never be captured in a test tube and a formula? How can we help create that approach to faith that will really be a source of healing and hope and reconciliation in our world? You know, that's what people like you and me are dedicated to. And I have a feeling a lot of folks actually left church and left religion because that's what they were hoping they could find. Mm-hmm. And I suppose what I hope people would take away from both my book and a conversation like this is maybe a little renewed hope and to say, you know what, there's some of us out there. This is what we want to do, and let's not give up.
Brian McLaren is an author, a speaker, a pastor. His numerous books include A New Kind of Christian, Everything Must Change, and now he's back with this one, the latest, A New Kind of Christianity, 10 Questions That Are Transforming the Faith. Brian, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks for joining us again on State of Belief.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for all the good you do for the people who listen.
There's lots more still ahead. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. There's an ancient Sufi maxim that says, when we see with the heart, all masks fall down. That's a sentiment that has guided my next guest through his career as a celebrated musician and a dedicated activist. For 20 years, Salman Ahmad has led the South Asian rock band Janoon. They became the first rock band to play at the UN General Assembly Hall in New York. And Salman has collaborated with Melissa Etheridge and Deepak Chopra on a peace campaign called Ring the Bells. While in his home country of Pakistan, he's seen his music repeatedly banned, and his message has drawn the fire of politicians and religious fundamentalists. But being banned from the radio and blacklisted from television didn't stop him as he launched what he's called a cultural jihad, a revolution to take back his country's roots of acceptance and coexistence. Salman Ahmad chronicles his efforts in a new book called Rock and Roll Jihad, A Muslim Rock Star's Revolution. And I am delighted to say that Salman Ahmad joins me right now. Welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me, Welton. It's my honor to be on your show.
Now, I want to point out, so people don't get preoccupied with this right up front, that you use the word revolution and the word jihad in the title of the book. And jihad, unfortunately, is a word that many Americans either misinterpret or insist on misinterpreting. But what you're talking about here is not violence. It's quite the opposite. It's peace. You're talking about a revolution fought not with guns but with guitars, right?
Well, you know, I use the J word against the advice of my publisher because I felt, Welton, that jihad, the word, was hijacked by Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and has been used and misused and abused, and now it seems like, you know, it's just stolen, and it's used for something which brings the images of sort of violence and fear and ugliness. And but the way I understood it growing up was jihad, the word in Muslim culture, means to strive, to overcome your ego, to overcome your limitations, to lift society up, to lift yourself up. It's a positive word. And I feel that, you know, it was a sinister case of identity theft that when the terrorists, you know, attacked the Twin Towers and the other buildings on that terrible day on 9/11, not only did they hijack jihad, but they hijacked Islam, Muslims. And I think it's about time that we rescued this word, which for me means a struggle for good.
Good for you. You were born in Pakistan, but you spent your early teenage years in New York. That's where you heard the Beatles and Led Zeppelin. You first joined a band. But when you went back to Pakistan in the early 80s, you found a Pakistan that was quite different from the one you left, one that was not necessarily hospitable to your dreams of becoming a rock star. Will you talk with us a little bit about the atmosphere you found when you went back to Pakistan?
Yeah, it was like landing on a different planet almost. You know, I went through junior high and high school here in Rockland County, New York, was in a garage band. My dreams were, you know, outrageous dreams of teenagers. You know, I wanted to be a rock star. And then, you know, I went back to study medicine in Lahore at a time where there was a military dictatorship which didn't allow any music on the radio, any music on TV. Live performances, you know, do them at your own peril, because as I tell in the book, my first ever attempt at playing guitar publicly was aborted. You know, I was 17, 18 years old at the time, and I just wanted to, you know, people to just see my talent. And there was this talent show organized by medical students, and we did it in secret because we knew that, you know, it was dangerous to do so. So I get up on stage after a juggler, and I'm looking at my 5 minutes of fame, and I close my eyes and I play this heavy metal guitar solo called Eruption, which was by Eddie Van Halen, you know, the 80s guitar hero. And as I was doing that, I had my eyes closed and I was tapping away with my fingers, and I started hearing shrieks and screams. So I'm telling myself, wow, I'm making a huge impact. But what had happened was that the extremist gate crashed. These kids were, you know, the morality police, the music police, and they started screaming, you know, fahashi, fahashi, which means, you know, vulgarity. And one of them, you know, with a crazed look in his eye, came up to the stage, took my Les Paul guitar, and smashed it on the ground.
Mm.
And that was my wake-up call. I said, where have I landed? And the other thing I thought at that time was that, wow, I thought rock musicians were supposed to smash their instruments.
Why didn't you quit?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I guess, you know, my mother is a Pashtun, and so am I. You know, so I have mixed ethnicity. I'm Pashtun from my mother's side, Punjabi from my father's. And the thing that's traditionally seen is that you can get us to do anything with love. You know, but the moment you start breaking things and you start threatening, there's another part of us which comes out, which is like, you know, I'm going to defy you. Mm-hmm. And if you want me to stop playing music, I'm going to do more of it. And that's what happened during my years there.
Salman, was social activism always a part of your understanding of music, or was that something that developed as your career developed?
Well, you know, if you grow up in Muslim culture, if you grow up in Pakistan, there's a very strong importance attached to social service, charity, you know, much like Christianity. Mm-hmm. And when I grew up, I had a, you know, role model in my mother, Shaheen, who did so much community service. You know, she spent, you know, weeks with friends and relatives, old relatives who were suffering with diseases. And, you know, my mother was a big, huge influence on me in that sense. And then, you know, the pressure of societal pressure of being a doctor, because, you know, like being a musician was not respected at all. It still is not as respected, one would say. And I kept being sort of brainwashed by my parents, you're going to become a doctor. You're going to become a doctor. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I went back to study medicine was because they saw that my musical passion was out of control. So While I was in med school, I went through 5 years of med school. I saw, you know, people living in extreme poverty, not getting the treatment that they deserved. And that must have also seeped into my consciousness, because when I left, you know, I told my parents, give me 1 year to play music. Hmm. And, you know, I didn't tell them how many days in that year. but all this music that I've, you know, performed, written, is connected to healing, and it's got a positive message.
I'm speaking today with Salman Ahmad, the founder of the rock band Janoon, and the author of the new memoir, Rock and Roll Jihad, A Muslim Rockstar's Revolution. Janoon has sold more than 30 million records in the past 20 years, but Salman Ahmad has seen his songs targeted by political leaders like Benazir Bhutto and even banned from the radio by former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. I asked Salman what reasons these politicians gave for banning his music.
Well, it's something about long hair and guitars. You know, they were fine with us singing songs, which are romantic songs, you know, which just were happy songs. But the moment you commented on, you know, political corruption or, you know, social commentary, mm-hmm. that's where we ran into trouble. We were on a tour of India when both countries tested nuclear weapons, and I made a statement, Welton, which said, you know, we want cultural fusion between India and Pakistan, not nuclear fusion.
Mm.
And also I wrote a song called Accountability, mm-hmm. Ittisab, with a video which criticized the corrupt political elite. And so they saw me, you know, they saw the band as troublemakers, and they banned us. You know, for one pretense or the other, they said, oh, you know, they're traitors because they want reunification of India and Pakistan, mm-hmm. which is not what we were saying. We were saying that, you know, both neighbors need to live together in peace.
Mm-hmm. That's the government side of it. But you also had the privilege of having the religious fundamentalists attack you as well. They found fault with your music.
Their criticism was that it's sacrilege to mix, you know, Sufi poems, which are spiritual poems, you know, for the love of God and for mm-hmm. love of humanity, with rock music, you know?
Hmm.
And the thing was, that's what made Janoon's music unique, was that on the one hand, it was influenced by Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and U2, but on the other hand, it was deeply grounded in tradition and it's a positive message of unity, which, you know, as you know, like, the people who follow Sufi Islam, you know, it's about nonviolence, it's mm-hmm. about seeking self-knowledge. It's about seeking oneness with God. And so a lot of the religious extremists, who, I have to say, are a minority, but a noisy, violent minority, mm-hmm. saw this as a threat to their power. So they try to ban us as well.
Salman, I am deeply grateful for you coming on, and I am totally supportive of what you're about in the world, and I thank you for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you. It was great jamming with you. Doesn't make a difference who you are. Doesn't even matter where you are. You're free.
How do you make a living? If a young person whom you know and care for requested your counsel on choosing a vocation, how likely is it that you would recommend that the young person become a poet? My guess is that most of us would not even think about recommending that choice for a life of work or any other profession related to the arts. Let's be realistic, we would say. You have to make a living. Continuing the hypothetical conversation, how would you answer if the student asked, what do you mean when you say make a living? Perhaps no part of our lives challenges our quality of life, including our spirituality, more than the work we do and the work that we want to do. My mind races to images of a friend from the past who despised his work in a factory, not because he wanted a less demanding job, but because he wanted a far more difficult job. I saw this man's spirit flogged flat because he had to work on an assembly line in order to have enough money to make financial ends meet while grieving because he could not devote himself to his calling that would involve tilling the soil and caring for plants that would require 15 hours a day on a tractor. I think of a woman working in a restaurant trying to collect enough tips that she can pay her bills by bussing tables while longing to get back to her work as an artist, devoting whatever amount of time was necessary to create images of beauty that would cause her spirit to soar. I think of a single mother aching to be at home with her young children every moment while she was seeking to excel in a profession that would bring her promotions and enough money to provide adequately for her family in the absence of a responsible husband and father. I think of a lawyer who dreams of being a musician, finishing his day at the firm so he can rush home and practice his music. Scores of people do not have the joy of doing the work that they want to do while longing for the fulfillment that comes in doing the work that they really feel called to do. The necessity of more income financially can stunt spiritual growth as well as consume time and energy to an extent that people cannot do what they feel they were made to do because of the heaviness of fatigue. How do people make a living in such a situation? All around us are individuals that have jobs but lack the ability to make a living, holistically speaking. Several years ago, I read a book entitled Crossing the Unknown Sea, Work as a Pilgrimage of Identity. I've reread that volume several times, wanting to be sure that I understand it. David White, the book's author, wrote about the subject of work using imagery drawn from poetry. Listen, please, to White's definition. Work, an opportunity for discovering and shaping the place where the self meets the world. How we handle our work and how we make a living involve our capacity to do our work in a manner that enables us to know ourselves better and to find ways to be at peace with how we relate to other people and to the world. Our work can either make us or break us in relation to who we are. Jobs are about money. Work is about life. But the art of making a living also centers on the impact of our work on others, something that has been evident in the past year in ways we haven't seen in a long time. The selfless work of healthcare workers called upon to risk their own health and that of their families to treat fellow Americans, including those who deny the pandemic, who actively oppose masks and vaccinations, and who criticize the medical establishment as corrupt and mendacious. There have been situations where politicians and hospital managers have betrayed their duties. But despite unfairness and neglect, the frontline workers continued to labor. I'm also thinking of the security personnel stepping up to stem the crisis of January 6th at the Capitol building police officers and other professionals putting their lives on the line to defend our democracy itself, because that is their job and their calling. Some gave their very lives in fulfilling their commitment to all of us. That is true patriotism, and it too is their labor. Then there are the journalists who continue to fearlessly report on the events undermining our government and society, exposing corruption and lies and people drinking horse medicine to cure COVID-19. This is a calling, but it too is labor in service to all of us. Public servants, emergency workers, all of those who kept the wheels of our society and economy turning through the unprecedented crises of the past year or more, we can't thank each one individually. I wish we could. But we can recommit to a recognition of the immense value non-famous, non-tweeting workers bring to the lives of each of us, and to demanding that fair treatment of working people remain an essential cornerstone of our values as a nation. Work truly is for the good of the world and for our good as well. Each of us needs to work, but there is this additional thought. None of us needs to work to the point that we wear out our lives and desensitize our ability to feel, to play, to pray, to relate to others, and to love lavishly. Over the years, I've asked countless leaders, activists, and public figures some version of this question. How do you keep doing what you're doing? How do you keep from burning out? The consistency of the answers is remarkable. People known for selfless labor in the service of their neighbor or their nation bluntly say, I take a month sabbatical every year. I make a retreat. I travel with family. I make sure I disconnect entirely for several weeks every summer. Nobody just keeps working without self-care and taking time away. And some of the most effective leaders make sure they take the time away to enable them to be most effective in their work. So whatever version of self-care is available to each of us, let's make sure we do it. After all, self-care is part of caring for creation, isn't it? This Labor Day weekend, there are scores of rescue workers busy in parts of our country struck by deadly storms. There are countless Americans foregoing the holiday to work extra shifts at hospitals and at jobs keeping the rest of us safe. There are others taking a well-deserved break, getting ready for the work that awaits in the weeks ahead. Happy Labor Day weekend, friends. This observance has taken on a profound new importance this year. Let's keep it in mind for ourselves and for each other. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.